This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a way, all of us are embedded reporters covering the war on drugs. In our schools, our offices, on our street corners, and in our hospitals and our malls, each of us has a unique view of a conflict that plays out in and beyond our borders and where we live and work. And the war is older than many of you. President Richard Nixon announced a war on drugs 35 years ago, a declaration renewed by each of his successors. Despite an estimated $500 billion and bulging prisons, critics charge there's not a lot to show for it. So what do you see? Call us if you're on the front lines as a cop, a prosecutor, as a current or former user. Call us with your dispatch from the war on drugs. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can file your report on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, how former CIA, MI5, and KGB agents are changing the world of corporate espionage and security. But first, the war on drugs. Last month, Rolling Stone magazine published an extensive article called How America Lost the War on Drugs by contributing editor Ben Wallace Wells, who joins us from the Audio Post studios in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And as you describe it, there is a moment where U.S. drug agents thought they had it in their hands, knew where their targets were, and how to hit them.
It was sort of an amazing moment in the war on drugs. Back just as the crack epidemic started to subside in the early 1990s, you had, you know, a series of victories. You had the number of cocaine users going down. You had Pablo Escobar captured. You had the Clinton administration coming in with the promise of a new approach to all sorts of domestic policies. And I think that there was a pivot point there in about 1993 or 1994 when it was possible to see the war on drugs going from being treated as a moral crisis and a moral problem to something more like a public health problem.
And yet, if there was a prospect of a victory, it quickly slipped away.
One of the things about the war on drugs, just that very term, is that the metaphor can contain a whole lot of different realities. I think at the beginning, at that point, in 1991, 1992, 1993, it was sort of a war as wars are seen from the Situation Room. You know, you had an enemy out there, you know, these Colombian cartels, and you had problems that they caused. And there was the promise that if you could go out there and put your hands around the neck of the bad guys, you might be able to stop the whole thing. Now, when you talk to prosecutors and cops and DEA agents, I think that the perspective is very similar to the one that we heard from that Pittsburgh police spokesman who you played in that clip. You know, it's a sense of a war as seen from the trenches, as a kind of, you know, ongoing slog where, you know, nobody sees much progress or fallback, but there's just the sense that this is a sort of permanent situation. And so the kind of the question that we wanted to ask as we went about reporting this article is, what is the history and sort of, you know, what's the story behind that stasis?
And to some degree, it's a political history. It's the various forces and movements that invoked this war in the first place and that have affected it. And, of course, part of the problem, as you describe it, is that as administrations change, sometimes even within administrations, new approaches come in that seem to vitiate past approaches. And some things are tried that might or might not work. But in any case, something new comes along, and that goes beyond by the boards. But to some degree, it's, you know, an overall look. And you really get down to the point when you say, look, there's three groups of drugs that people have tried to attack. And you describe them as basically the hippie drugs, marijuana and LSD. Then there is the plague of heroin, a very nasty drug, but one largely confined to a few big cities, mostly on America's East Coast. And then there's cocaine. And the cocaine story is really what you write a lot about.
Well, I think that the cocaine story is much of the story of the war on drugs between, you know, 1985 or so and the present day. Now, of course, you have things like methamphetamine, which has its own unique problems and its own possible solutions as well. But cocaine was the moment when this thing began to take on its own kind of epic character, when it seemed as if, you know, I remember growing up in New York in the late 1980s and stepping on crack vials in the schoolyard, you know. My father worked in New York City's foster care system at the time, and they had just an explosion of kids who'd been abandoned by drug-addicted moms. And there was this sort of, you know, panic in the late 80s about, you know, Just the feeling that this thing could overwhelm cities and overwhelm a huge, you know, number of service providers, and that there was a kind of new dimension, a new character to the war on drugs now. And so that, so I think the history since then is one of policies that were, you know, in large part designed around figuring out how to you know, make the cocaine problem less problematic.
And a lot of it you seem to criticize, in particular General Barry McCaffrey, who was the former drug czar, of course, and his approach of attacking marijuana as a gateway drug towards these other drugs, a statement which on the one hand seems to be accurate, on the other hand it seems to be beside the point.
McCaffrey's really a sort of fascinating figure. He was a person who came in at a moment when the drug czar's office in the mid-90s had lost a lot of its, you know, its public podium, its bully pulpit. It simply wasn't as prominent. And McCaffrey was this figure who was turned to by the Clinton administration at a moment when it was being accused by Republicans and by some voters of being weak on law and order and issues like this. And so they wanted this strong symbolic figure to win back the battle. And he, in a couple of ways that we can talk about if you'd like, you know, sort of became convinced that the problem here began with marijuana, began with young users. And he started to, you know, orient the nation's drug policy to fight that. And, you know, this is a reported piece, not an argued one. And yeah. It's not me who's criticizing him. You know, we have people like his former legislative liaison who talks about walking with him into meetings of members of Congress, who are saying, you know, General, I just can't understand why all the focus on marijuana. We have real drug problems in this country. Methamphetamine, and this is in 98, 99, is beginning to spiral out of control. Why are we focused on marijuana when there are more, you know, more obviously problematic drug abuse patterns going on out there? And like you say, you know, the gateway drug theory is certainly a hotly contested one. And I, you know, there's a lot of evidence presented on both sides, but it's hard to claim that the attention to reducing marijuana has resulted in any kind of, you know, associated decline in hard drugs used or drugs used in addictive ways. And I think the contention of most public health experts and sort of policy experts is that those patterns of use are the ones we should be concerned about.
We're asking listeners to call in with their reports from the war on drugs. How have you seen it in your life, in your workplace, as you pass through your city? Give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Jack. Jack's calling us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes, I have a personal anecdote to relate. I have a younger brother. He's 45. Arrested two nights ago for possession of crack cocaine. He's been a long-term drug addict, almost 30 years now. I would agree that the cocaine epidemic in this country, it's outrageous now. It's everywhere. It's much more pernicious than the softer drugs that seem to be around. It's the great evil three. It's cocaine, it's heroin, and it's crystal methamphetamine that are blowing people's minds apart. And I don't think that incarceration is going to be the solution. I don't think we can incarcerate our way out of the problem. But there really is an epidemic out there. And
what is your brother facing at this point?
I don't know. He was arraigned yesterday, and trying to raise bond now. So he needs to be in a treatment program, but he is very adamant and objects to treatment. And he's been through rehab a couple of times and goes right back to smoking crack again. It's a pernicious drug. It's a terrible thing. And it's so involved with the crime and the gang activity that's going on now. Maybe not so much in major cities now, but smaller cities like the Columbia has a terrible gang and crack problem right now.
Well, Jack, we wish you and your brother good luck.
Yeah, well, I wish us all good luck. I just don't see real solutions. Hope we can find one.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Let's go to another caller. This is Tom. Tom with us from Wadesboro in North Carolina.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I'm a police officer here, and you know, I agree with what your guest is saying. They're emphasizing too much on marijuana. You know, I have yet to find anyone who's broken into a house or rob somebody to get money for marijuana. seems like all the crimes that are committed around here are mainly by the crack users. I find that the methamphetamine users are doing a lot of theft, stealing copper wire and stuff like that from people's houses. So, you know, I don't know if there's a solution to the marijuana thing, but I think if they emphasize more on your harder drugs like crack and cocaine and methamphetamines and heroin, you'd probably get a little more done.
Okay, thanks, and good luck to you, too.
All right.
Bye-bye. And Ben Wallace Wells, as you listen to those accounts, and of course they're just two little snapshots, but after all of this time, all of this money, all of this effort, is cocaine cheaper? Is it harder to find than it used to be? What's happened?
There's basically been not a lot of change since 1992 or so. You have momentary fluctuations, increases or decreases in price or availability. But for the most part, this is a drug whose user population is pretty constant. There are a couple of interesting things that have happened among drugs in general and also among among the cocaine use population. One is there are a whole lot more older people who are using drugs now, and in part this is a consequence of the baby boom generation just getting into their 60s and still keeping their old habits, and in part it's a consequence of you know, I think it improves sort of medical care. So, you know, people are able to continue drug use for a long time. That's something that I hadn't expected when I started reporting this story. An earlier caller brought up treatment, and this is sort of a kind of interesting issue. Most of the serious public policy scholars say that the most promising direction in terms of reducing demands for drugs and reducing problematic use is to focus money on drug treatment, on, you know, methadone programs for heroin users, on you know, what therapies exist for cocaine users. And though nobody says that's perfect, most people do say that is sort of the direction the policy ought to be headed.
We'll talk more about that and other innovative approaches to try to combat the war on drugs when we return. Stay with us. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Rolling Stone contributing editor Ben Wallace Wells. He wrote the article, How America Lost the War on Drugs. You can find a link to that article at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And, of course, we're all reporters in this conflict. Give us your snapshot of the war on drugs, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and check out that blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now is Jonathan Calkins. He's done extensive research on drug policy, a different view on the war on drugs. He joins us today from the studios of member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Nice of you to join us.
It's my pleasure.
And is this a conflict that has had very little effect after $500 billion in 35 years?
Well, it all depends on what you're comparing it to. If you think that we ought to have been able to eliminate drug use, then no, we haven't done that and we won't be able to. But it could be a whole bunch worse if we had not done the things that we are doing.
Have we reduced drug use?
It's not so much that we've been able to reduce drug use, but that the drug epidemic has stabilized and it is slowly ebbing. We're managing a problem that has emerged. And that's a good thing. You don't judge AIDS control efforts by the standard of whether or not AIDS has been eliminated. Likewise, we can't think about trying to get back to the levels of drug use before 1960.
If cocaine, for example, is purer than it's ever been and just about as inexpensive as it's ever been, isn't that a stinging indictment of a long-time policy?
If you think that the objective of law enforcement is to eliminate cocaine use, then that might be a stinging indictment. But I think that we can look to law enforcement to help us control drug market-related violence and the disorder that it creates in cities around the country. And then you can see some important successes. The homicide rate in New York City has plummeted, and an awful lot of that homicide in New York City was drug-related. There have been enormous drops in youth violence in Boston. Again, it was often drug-related. And law enforcement contributed to that decline in a very important way. So if we focus on using law enforcement to control some of the side effects of the drug markets, there are opportunities to succeed, and there have been some successes.
And some successes. So perhaps I think what I'm hearing from you is that war on drugs, really inappropriate metaphor.
Absolutely.
Yet it's been something that has been broadly accepted by, I guess, every president since Richard Nixon.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They've all used it at least occasionally, but if you really read carefully the Office of National Drug Control Policy literature, they stopped using the war metaphor more than a decade ago.
More than a decade ago, yet we still generally, and perhaps this is our fault, refer to the official put in charge as the drug czar.
That's correct.
Yeah. And as you look at this policy, and it's certainly funded as if it's a very important government policy, $500 billion over 35 years, you can think of a lot of things that could have been done with that money.
That's right. Well, and I think it is very important. There are components of that spending that we probably could have done better just doing less of. And the two best examples of that are incarcerating relatively low-level sellers who were easily replaced. That doesn't accomplish much. The second thing that doesn't accomplish much is trying to control the crop production back in source countries. But most of the rest of that spending wasn't necessarily spending too much. The drug problem is a very large problem. It's a very important problem. You might ask for it to have been spent a little bit more effectively, but I don't necessarily think we should have been trying less hard.
Mm. Ben Wallace Wells, let me bring you back in. The programs that have reduced violence associated with drugs, you write about those in your article and indeed say there have been some important successes there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, one thing that, to be clear about is that, you know, these are awfully important problems. And I don't think, you know, there are some people who are legalizers who say that, you know, we've done so poorly with drug policy that we ought to, you know, throw this whole prohibition scheme out the window. I incline much more towards Professor Calkins' view that there have been some successes in some places we could have, you know, certainly done a lot more, have had a lot more efficient spending of resources. When we talk about law enforcement, Professor Calkins cited a couple of the more evident successes. We talk about some pilot programs that a scholar named David Kennedy has begun beginning in Boston, but then spooling out in a couple of dozen cities around the country that sort of seek to separate drug violence from drug markets. And in some of these cases, there's even a sort of tacit acknowledgement that, you know, even if we can't do very much about the amount of drugs being consumed, we can, sort of begin to separate that constant use from some of the problems that exist. And
particularly,
I think
the guns and violence.
Yeah, particularly the murders and the shootings.
And yet, some people will look at that and say, well, that's fine and well. How can police authorities say, we're going to work to reduce gun violence, but if the cost of that is to say drug use goes on, that's unacceptable?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that part of what has to happen is there has to be a sort of reconception of what we're looking at. Some of the problems associated with drugs are really, really serious and really, really horrible. And some of them, you know, are tolerable. And the question, you know, look, there's a whole lot of drug use that goes on in suburbs, but nobody says that, you know, suburbs are succumbing to plagues of drugs and violence. And I think that part of the question and part of the direction of some of these more innovative approaches is how can we get cities to look at cities that are, you know, caught up in the problems associated with drug violence to look a little bit more like the suburbs.
And Jonathan Calkins, I wanted to ask you, we've seen recent court decisions and policy decisions by here in Washington, D.C., reducing the difference between sentencing, for example, for crack cocaine and powdered cocaine. Do you think that's a step in the right direction?
Yes, it absolutely is.
All right, let's see if we can get some more callers on the line. Again, we're asking you to be our reporters embedded in the war on drugs. Let's turn to Robert. Robert with us, Columbus, Ohio.
Hello. In the past, I've worked as a political activist, and I've worked in the neighborhoods, in the midst of many neighborhoods, and I moved here from Cleveland. Well, I tell you, crack is an epidemic to the point where I witnessed kids, I mean, 8, 9-year-old kids, out on bikes, peddling crack, and they know that the parents sending them out there, the kids are only going to get a record that will be absolved when they're 18. So therefore, the parents are staying out of jail. And I asked a police station here in Columbus. They said, yeah, that's exactly what's happening, and our hands are tied. Now, how can money be used more effectively when there's a lackadaisical approach even amongst the police force?
Lackadaisical approach from the police?
Yes, yes, because it's such an epidemic. All they have is helicopters in this town going around in the poorer neighborhoods, and that's it. And I've only lived here a year, but that's what I've observed in the neighborhoods. It's rampant, and it's crack. You know, and it destroys the neighborhoods. I mean, you see, the answer is just to board up all these homes, and so these poorer neighborhoods are even more susceptible to drug use, because then you have illegal drug use in these abandoned homes, and then you have fires that occur from this use.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, how do they say the war on drugs is effective when you see this in the communities?
Jonathan Calkins, what do you think?
I think the general principle that both Ben and I have made reference to is trying to target the nastiest dealers, the ones that cause the most damage to society. And the first thing you always mention is the violence. But number two on the list is dealers who employ kids. And not very far down the list are dealers who sell flagrantly on street corners and terrorize neighborhoods. If, quote-unquote, all law enforcement were able to do would be to push all of the selling into back corner selling between adults that's invisible to the general community, some people would say, that didn't reduce the amount of drug use. I would still say that's an important accomplishment, and that might change Robert's neighborhood in an important way.
Robert, thanks very much. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Lee. Lee with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, I just want to say I'm very disillusioned about how far we've come in the war on drugs. I kind of saw it from two sides. I grew up in a family that had a lot of drug abuse. My brother started out smoking pot and drinking, eventually met a drug he could not beat. He died of an OxyContin overdose about 2 years ago. I'm like almost 50 years old. I work at a major chain grocery store, and I'm disillusioned and disappointed to say that many of my coworkers, some of them middle-aged people, come to work high on marijuana and other drugs. And I just think, how far have we come? I mean, it's just, I think it's horrible. Is it that accepted?
Ben Wallace Wells, I wonder, as you did your reporting, did you find it as something that's accepted in American society, whereas Lee says, people who come to work every day stoned?
I think that's anomalous. I mean, you know, one of the things that's consistent here in the anecdotes is, look, you're gonna remember the horrible stuff much more than you're gonna remember the casual stuff. There are plenty of people who, you know, use marijuana a bunch of times and then stop, who use cocaine a few times and then stop. You know, sure, these are highly addictive substances, but you know, it's some of them. But you know, it's still not like every. You know, everybody who tries cocaine once ends up coming into work stoned for the next 30 years. But there is a real power to the anecdotes and to the experience of being around people who have grappled with addiction that I think, you know, ups that sense of disillusionment and sort of contributes to frustrations like those of your caller.
And Lee, we're very sorry to hear about your brother.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. Here's an email from Michael in Portland, Oregon. As a criminal defense practitioner for 20 years, I've always been under the impression that the warriors, federal, state, and local law enforcement in this war, are often not completely motivated to actually win this war. They have their own turf wars and money interests that make the win antithetical to their own purposes, survival and expansion of their own agencies. Ben Wallace Wells, you write a lot about the various agencies that go to the front lines in this conflict. What do you think?
Certainly, a lot of turf wars. I'd be hesitant about saying that you know, the drug warriors aren't interested in winning. One of the things you find as you go through this is that, you know, there's a very zealous belief among most, you know, at least federal drug agents that you know, this is a vicious problem and needs serious combating. What you do find is a certain sense that, you know, things aren't necessarily getting better, and a kind of, you know, a readjustment of as I talked about at the beginning, of the way we view this kind of nebulous metaphor, the war on drugs, and the kind of new assumption that these are problems that are going to be with us and that we're going to be fighting in a kind of ongoing way for a very long time, that victory is not, you know, something that's sort of appropriate to think about in this context.
Jonathan Calkins, he's talking about a reference to not a blitzkrieg by any stretch of the imagination, more war in the trenches, a war of attrition, if you will. Is that a more appropriate analogy?
Well, it's better, but I'd like to get away from war altogether. I just think it's a public management problem that we have to deal with on an ongoing basis, the same way we try to manage general street crime or pollution or various health problems.
We're talking about what's been accomplished 35 years and $500 billion later. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me reintroduce our guests, Ben Wallace Wells, contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. How America Lost the War on Drugs is his article. And again, you can see a link to that article at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Also with us, Jonathan Calkins, professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University's Hines School of Public Policy. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Lisa with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi. Yes, I was actually calling today because I am a formal crystal meth addict. I have been 7 years sober, clean, perfectly fine. And while I abhor any drugs, period, and I purposely encourage anyone and everyone I know that I meet that is on drugs to quit immediately, I do see that the more violent crimes that are in America, that are around the country, period, and all the travels I've done, are done by the people who are on crystal meth, cocaine, crack, all of those hard drugs. And while I wish that the quote, war on drugs, were more focused on those drugs, that I don't know, I have a hard time explaining this. I just really wish that they would focus more on the harder drugs, because the people who are doing the harder drugs are the ones that are attacking all of these innocent people that should not be having their lives affected this way. I even had a friend that died this past year because he was working in the night shift in a gas station and a drug addict shot him 5 times and left him for dead. You don't see a pothead doing that. They're sitting at home with a bag of potato chips and an Adam Sandler movie. Yeah. They're not anywhere near doing any of the things that the people who are on the harder drugs, these drugs that are causing more and more problems, those are the people that we need to be focusing on.
Lisa, let me ask you, first of all, congratulations, but meth is a notoriously difficult drug to get out of. How did you do it?
I actually had an overdose, died in the hospital.
You died in the hospital?
It was a complete wake-up call. My family came and got me. I never went into rehab. I basically sat at home and let myself be sick and get over it on my own. It was a very big wake-up call to die over something so stupid and trivial. I have too many things, too many people who love me in life, and I never realized it till that happened.
Again, congratulations, and we're glad you made it.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call.
I hope someone listening to this has realized that they can do it, too.
I hope so, too.
Thank you.
And Ben Wallace Wells, the war on meth, again, I'm using the analogy, you're not, but the fight against methadone has been long and very difficult and very convoluted, yet even there you said there was a moment.
Well, the people at the DEA certainly think so. Back in the late 80s, there were, you know, methamphetamine requires some complex chemicals in order to make, and they're not chemicals that you can simply, you know, cook up on your stove. You need basic chemicals that are only manufactured at a few factories around the world. You need really industrial scale pharmaceutical facilities to do it. The DEA set out in the mid-80s under the leadership of a man named Gene Haslip to try to control those precursor chemicals, to get agreements with countries where they were produced to restrict their flow across international borders, and in those cases where the precursor chemicals were produced in the United States to win legislation to restrict them.
And there's a meeting that you describe, and Mr. Haslip comes out saying, "Hey, I've got it knocked. This is going to happen."
It was a meeting with some figures from the Reagan White House. The thing he didn't notice in the meeting was that there were lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry there, and part of the, not to further demonize an industry which has been, you know, plenty demonized, but part of the issue here is that the same precursor chemicals that go to make meth also go to, you know, make very profitable allergy medications. And so over the course of about 8 or 10 years, as the DEA pursued this effort to restrict these chemicals, the pharmaceutical industry sort of fought them tooth and nail. And, you know, eventually we had basic restrictions on these chemicals that have turned out to be very effective, but it was very late and a long time in coming.
One of the stories Ben Wallace Wells tells in his Rolling Stone magazine article, How America Lost the War on Drugs. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Ben Wallace Wells with the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. Our thanks as well to Jonathan Calkins, professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, the new hire moving into the cubicle next to you just might be a former spy. Stay with us.